mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Now with Dr. Robert Brennan, and my very special guest and the lady of the hour is Professor Robin Cosford. Robin is an expert in integrative medicine and a medical practitioner herself. She's a fellow of the Australian College of Nutritional Environmental Medicine, and she's a conjoint lecturer, now with a professorial title, at Newcastle Uni, which is a uni that I never studied with, but I'd have to say it's my favourite because it has this gigantic cafeteria called the Brennan Room, so it's named after me. No, it's not. But anyway, so good evening, Robin. How are you doing?
Hello, Robert. Great, thank you. What an honour to be here. It's just awesome to know that we've got this radio program out there spreading the story, which is awesome.
Spreading the message of freedom and responsibility, I guess, furthering on from the themes of my previous talk on a political sort of context. But when it comes to medicine and science, interested in the pursuit of objective truths without conflict with political agendas, with globalist and supra corporate interest, et cetera, et cetera. So you're all part of that fight against that.
Very, very much so. I should just correct one thing, conjoint lecturer, University of Newcastle, but my professorship is actually an honorary position that was conferred by Professor Ian Brighthope on the basis of the fact that I've been a senior lecturer for many years to ACNM and and at other medical conferences. So that actually wasn't conferred by the Uni of Newcastle.
Ah, well, there's a story in that. We'll get to that. But first of all, I guess, you know, when I use the term integrative medicine, some of our listeners might be wondering, well, what is that?
What does that mean?
Yes.
Exactly. Well, my story there is a little different in the sense that I'm one of a small handful in Australia of doctors who are actually doubly trained, in the sense that I was trained in naturopathy, nutrition, homeopathy before I completed medicine. And so when I completed medicine, I did start specialty training, but then decided to have another three kids. So that kind of put a codwash on that one. So I moved straight across into naturopathic medicine. Now, in general, what integrative medicine means is to integrate. It's a much better term than one that a lot of people might have heard, alternative medicine. It shouldn't be alternative. Nutritional and environmental medicine is the other term that I like. It's where we are using nutritional biochemistry and environmental factors, lifestyle factors, and recognizing their contribution to health and wellness. And so a good integrative doctor will be taking a much broader history and will be looking into things like nutrition, lifestyle factors, environmental factors to get a sense of what contribution or what level of contribution those factors are making to that particular person's situation. And because often we can make a massive impact on health by looking at those factors without going anywhere near any medication.
And do you find that, I mean, notionally, regular doctors would say, well, we're interested in nutrition and lifestyle also. What's your take on that, though? The idea that notionally they would say that they're interested in the same, and yet there is nonetheless a point of distinction between a lot of, let's say, orthodox mainstream medical practice and integrative medicine.
I think there's a beautiful case that sums the answer up to that up very well. And this was a well-known case of an orthopedic surgeon. I won't use his name here so I don't cause any more trouble, but an orthopedic surgeon who noted a strong correlation between patient diet and their symptomatic osteoarthritis. So he's an orthopod. Given that orthopods are used to correcting orthopedic problems surgically, this automatically puts him into a different category. So he started recommending basically a low inflammatory diet and with some other simple things for his patients. And lo and behold, it worked and his patients were getting better. But believe it or not, he got into trouble with the medical council because the Dietitians Association accused him of practicing outside of his scope of training in medicine. So a doctor who was giving nutritional advice was deregistered for giving nutritional advice.
Yes, yes. So, I've had that
crazy,
doctor on our show, in fact, and so I can name him. That's Dr. Gary Fetke, I imagine. That's the gentleman we're talking about.
Exactly who I'm talking about. So a crazy situation. Certainly it is indisputable. It's true, and it's just plain fact that within the standard medical system, doctors receive not even a series of lectures on biochemistry and nutritional biochemistry. Mm-hmm. The nutritional training is exceedingly poor.
Mm-hmm.
There are no lectures on lifestyle medicine. There are no lectures based around exercise. Well, at least there weren't when I last looked at the course. No exercises based around lifestyle medicine. Lectures around lifestyle medicine, exercise, this sort of thing. And indeed, in recognition of that, there's a whole new college set up, the Australian Society of Lifestyle Medicine,
mm-hmm.
Which incorporates not just doctors but also physiologists, exercise physiologists, you know, and all of these other people who actually, and psychologists in there as well, who actually do look at the evidence base for lifestyle interventions in medicine. And most doctors simply do not look at that. They might make a passing comment, by the way, you should stop smoking, mm-hmm. or by the way, maybe you should do a little bit of exercise. Maybe you should stop putting 6 teaspoons of sugar in your tea. But really, your standard doctors have, unless they have done postgraduate training specifically, mm-hmm. your standard doctors have not received training in nutritional and or environmental medicine, and they don't have it as a significant part of their consultations because the whole of the medical system, sadly, literally is owned by the pharmaceutical industry and is geared basically, as you would know, on an algorithm basis, mm-hmm. which is that you get a set of symptoms, you run through this checklist of check this, check that, do this, this test, that test, stick the patient in a box, what's the name on that box, what's the drug that matches that box.
Mm. Yes, and the algorithm is something that is sold to us on the basis of, well, it's just a guideline, one can step out of it, but then quickly it becomes something where the medical student is expected to remember it because it's a shortcut to how they might answer a question. The trainee in whatever specialty guild they're in is required to remember it because that's what they need to know for their exams. And so quickly it becomes a case of, well, that is the gospel and that's that. Yeah.
Exactly. So they are literally trained out of thinking.
Uh-huh.
Medicine actively trains you out of thinking through what might be the underlying disease process, mm-hmm. what might have happened that has resulted in the body throwing this particular reaction that then we have labeled as this disease.
Mm.
We are, you know, we are trained out of how to do that.
Yes. And the more horrifying thing is in this technocratic world and a higher level of health management with regard to hospital management is that you and I, we are steps on their algorithm. So we're lost from being humans altogether. Yeah. But that's a sort of looking at the meta level. Do you think some of the problem is, part of the problem is the giving of the profession away to the pharmaceutical establishment, mm-hmm. to colleges and their guidelines
Absolutely.
And like, but also is a problem, say, information overload, the fact that there's so many fields, so many journals, so many, there's an assumption of so many expertises that no one can have?
I think certainly that would be a case. I think a lot of GPs, just rather than trying to get to understand processes themselves, I mean, I see it all the time with this expected referral basis that the second anything is a tiny bit more complicated, you're supposed to refer them off.
Mm-hmm.
GPs aren't doing any of their own thinking to seek to understand things. And it actually isn't that difficult if you are prepared to, bit by bit, when a new thing comes in, go, okay, I want to understand this. And you do your own looking to understand that thing. And bit by bit, you find that you're able to develop a rather large mind map that will connect this to this, to that, to that. Because, in fact, your general practitioner is a much better place to be able to do that than your super, super specialist. because their viewpoint is so narrow. Yes, they might know an amazing amount, but it's about this tiny thing. Whereas a good generalist, we've lost the good generalist. We used to have, as you would remember, we used to have very good general physicians, and these were my preferred guys, because they actually were able to look across and understand across a wide variety of what we would now call subspecialties, and get a much bigger look at things. So yes, certainly I think fear of information overload, not necessarily information overload itself, but fear that I can't possibly know that, so I'm not even going to try, rather than I can learn enough into that field that I can actually communicate really well with those guys, and I can pull pictures together, and I can actually do something more meaningful for my patient as a result.
Yes. And I'm thinking that also part of the problem might be in the compartmentalization of various subfields. And you can imagine sort of an absurd horizon where the GP would be just a source of referral, because they could say, well, exercise physiology and dietetics is not my thing, and psychology is not my thing, and there'd be a specialty for everything. And so what do they do at the end of the day?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. But that's exactly what it has devolved to, in that most GPs are really basically doing that. Yes, they'll check blood pressure and do basic bloods and write another SSRI script or something like that. But in terms of actually understanding what's going on with their patient and actually bringing their patient towards a place of healing, well, no, the patient's chopped up into all these little bits, and okay, here's the referral for your cardiologist, and here's the referral for your gastroenterologist, and here's the referral for your endocrinologist for your, you know, your bone scans and your osteoporosis treatment, and here's your referral for your psychiatrist, and exactly.
Yes.
So you move into polypharmacy, where each one of these specialists is prescribing their own preferred drugs. And every pharmaceutical, even paracetamol, every pharmaceutical carries its own side effect profile. So we start moving into polypharmacy, where the drug side effects are being thrown and then another drug is prescribed to counter the side effects. And it's just ludicrous.
Yes. And yet, as you say, there are some wonderful GPs out there, particularly those where they come from pre-algorithmic times when they had to generate their own synthesis of knowledge, and also the procedural GPs and the rural ones that seem to be able to do everything. And, you know, like the guys out of South Africa.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Some of those, and those are your true doctors, you know, the ones who really can, you know, move in and really do things. But our standard city GP in modern society, no, totally, well, really, for want of a better term, emasculated. You know, they don't know how to pick up a scalpel. They wouldn't know where to go with anything. They can't do anything. They are little more than prescription pad pushers, you know, pharmaceutical reps and coordinators of specialist referrals, to be honest.
And I'll have to say, I'm the first to be self-deprecating, because after a career in psychiatry, I didn't pick up the stethoscope for God knows how many years. But we know our way around the literature, at least, which gives us a bit of a hand in these times. We're going to go to a quick ad break. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in a couple of minutes.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Here is a broadcast by Pauline Hanson's One Nation for federal election.
Since the introduction of family law in 1975, it has done nothing but destroy families and the lives of too many Australians. I have a big problem with domestic violence and the lies. I am sick and tired of hearing about another suicide, and I feel for those families that have lost their loved ones because of murders that have happened. It can only change if we actually make it happen. The lawyers have made a field day out of this, ripping the guts out of parents and taking everything from them. At the end of the day, they've got nothing left. They're destroyed. If we want change here, then we deal with the perjury, we deal with the lies, we deal with taking the kids away from innocent parents who are fighting tooth and nail just to spend time with their children.
Authorised by R. Miles for Pauline Hanson's One Nation Brisbane. Spoken by Pauline Hanson and Elle Appleton.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player. No matter the challenges I face every day in the NFL, my mom is always there for me, despite her own struggles with muscular dystrophy. And MDA is there for my mom. At their 150 care centers across the U.S., MDA is a leading organization in research and care for kids and adults with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and related neuromuscular diseases. Join me and learn more at helpmda.org today. Thank you.
Show me the studies.
Today's News Talk Radio.
True study. This is safe for adults, much less kids.
TNT Radio. Live.
This is Robert Brennan and my very special guest, Professor of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, Robert Cosford. One of the things I wanted to do, and that's why I wanted to focus on the integrative for a moment, is that I wanted to take the, let's say, the shine away from the cathedral of assumed expertise that has ruined our lives the last couple of years in this COVID era, and to just reflect the story back on you, and can you tell me what you think? I remember back in the – I'm looking in the literature now, and there's a lot this past few years on the gut microbiome. And yet I remember it was the integrative medicine people back in the 1980s that were talking about bowel flora, good and bad bacteria, the gut microbiome, and the concept of the leaky gut and all of this sort of thing. They were way ahead of the curve, weren't they?
Exactly. And that's where my time was, the University of Newcastle, back in 1986, I think. Mm-hmm. It was 1986. The University of Newcastle at that time, there was a phenomenal team together in the School of Biological Sciences. And I was just blessed to be a part of that. And we were investigating, initially it was chronic fatigue syndrome at that time that we were investigating. But as part of all of what was being done, we were looking at plasma, red blood cell indices. We were looking at urinary biochemical markers. And we were looking at gut microbes, what was coming out, fecal microbial analysis, what was coming out in the gut. And so this was back in 1986. The original data we got out of there was, it was groundbreaking at that time. It was world level. But unfortunately, the team broke up for various kind of personal and political reasons, and that didn't come out. But the point I'm making is exactly as you said, that back 35, you know, years ago, those of us who were in this field were already studying this and making these connections and beginning to prove how vitally important the patterns are of gut microbes are to determining total health. And now, of course, it has made it into mainstream. There are thousands upon thousands of papers now written about gut dysbiosis, written about, you know, intestinal permeability. Leaky gut was totally poo-pooed, but it's now recognized in ulcerative colitis and in inflammatory bowel disease, in autoimmune diseases, and so on and so on and so on. So yeah, it's now mainstream, which is exciting. And one person in particular who's great to listen on this is Professor Ian Brighthope, who's been around even longer than I have, and he was my original mentor, and said he's the one who conferred my professorship. But so Ian would make the statement how we would have started off doing things and then the system takes it up and owns it. And there's never any, and in the time when we started, we are poo-pooed, we are, you know, we're crazy, we're all of these things. But then once the system starts to own it, there is never, ever any acknowledgement that the integrative medicine, complementary medicine, nutritional medicine, whatever you want to call this group, we're actually correct. Never.
Yes.
It is simply, hey, wow, aren't we so clever? We have found this out and look at this, and they blow their trumpets and, you know, we are wonderful. And those of us who've been around a long time just kind of smile and nod and go, yeah, we tried to tell you that 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so is there any like latest and greatest findings in gut microbiome work that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Oh, there is so much in all of this. I think that the simple take home for listeners to know is that, and I say this to patients, that when we eat, the first thing we feed is our gut bacteria. So we can really pretty much totally determine the health of the rest of our body by what we are feeding our gut bacteria. Because what we eat changes not only the pattern of the gut bacteria themselves, because certain bacteria feed on different things, but also the metabolites that those bacteria make. And those metabolites then interact both with the gut immune system, with our own system. They'll go through the liver and affect the liver, connect with the neurotransmitter, the messaging system in the gut wall, so that we alter our neurotransmitter messages. So truly, we are what we eat. We are made out of what we, not only are we made out of what we eat, but what we eat alters these bacteria that alters the messaging through the whole of the body. So we don't necessarily, you know, years ago, 20, 30 years ago, the whole thing in the naturopathic circles was everything was candida, everything was candida.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. But what was correct about that was that the foods that feed your yeast, yeasts are actually, candida is actually microbiologically, what I won't be rude, but it's a weak organism. Mm-hmm. It really is a weak organism, and it cannot tissue invade and cause problems unless the immune system is severely impaired, like you would see post-chemo or something like that. In those cases, it can. But otherwise, it's a really weak organism. But what's interesting is that that same, let's call it the Candida diet, which is your low sugar and particularly your low sugar and low carb diet, feeds a whole other group of highly pathogenic bacteria that are highly toxigenic. So inadvertently, if you like, or by the by, people who were doing the Candida diet and thought it was Candida they were fixing, it's more likely that what they were doing was altering the levels of these other bacteria and bacterial toxins in their system. So we don't really need to know the names of what it is that's doing it, but the key is that good food,
mm-hmm.
traditional food, lots of greens, you know, lots of greens, lots of nuts and seeds and olive oil and healthy fibers, as distinct from, and I love the term that we use, the SAD diet. Mm-hmm. You know, it says it all, SAD, standard American diet, standard Australian diet. The SAD diet is very sad, both for the patterns of the gut bacteria that it promotes, but also the highly toxigenic and inflammatory products that are made from those gut bacteria when they are fed that diet. And so a simple change in diet, 2/3 of my patients will make a significant improvement in their body health just by changing their diet. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's not a hard thing to do really, but yes.
Yes, and that's what Fetke was advocating as well. And because if you open yourself up to more than the conventional, and you might have been, if you did a naturopathic course of some description, you would have been exposed to all sorts of modalities. So are there any that you've dropped along the way? I mean, you know, there's homeopathy, iris diagnosis, there's various forms of physical manipulation, and there's applied kinesiology. Yeah. And so is there any that you've dropped along the way as thinking, well, no, this doesn't really work?
There aren't any that I've dropped because, no, this doesn't really work, but it becomes a question of how much can I do in my setting in one consult.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trained also in acupuncture, medical acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
and along the way I dropped that out because the physicality of running separate rooms and separate beds and running from patient to patient, you know, and only doing short times with each patient didn't work in the framework. And that's where I rather like psychiatry, you know, that you actually have a good time sitting with a patient, talking to them, feeling them, connecting with them. And that's my preferred style of medicine, is connecting with people. Mm-hmm. So I found that acupuncture didn't fit that, even though it's effective, very effective. So I dropped that. I do still, and so I am a bit crazy, I do still look in the eyes. It's only I will not use iridology as a diagnostic tool, but it gives you some clues. I am trained in kinesiology, applied kinesiology, and I do use that often, again, as an adjunct just to figure out what the system's doing. I'm trained as a homeopath and I use homeopathy fairly routinely, but not only because your big limitations with homeopathy is that homeopathy works in energy signaling. You are signaling to the system, but the system has to generate the response. And that's well and good if the system is clean. That's well and good if the environment is clean. But the problem we have now with homeopathy is because people are exposed to EM the whole time. Mm-hmm. They're exposed to other toxins. A homeopathic signal might only hold for a few minutes, maybe. It certainly won't hold like it used to historically. And the same thing for kinesiology. I take a bit of a beef with these kinesiologists out there who will get an energy shift and then say, I've just cured you. And it's like, well, yes, you've got a temporary energy shift in the system, but unless we do something else to help sustain that energy shift, it won't hold. So that's the limitation of all the energy therapies. Favorite therapy is herbs. Herbs are probably my absolute favorite go-to. I love herbs.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Which for the naysayers of homeopathy, the herbs are substances that don't exist in an energetic form but actually exist in a molecular form.
Exactly. That's a definite advantage to them. They are a physical substance. And you can, I think where a lot of doctors trip up on herbs, and I know I did initially before I actually spent the time to sit and analyze it, is how can one herb possibly have so many actions? Because when you read anything about a herb, there's this list of 20, 30, 40, 50 even, you know, therapeutic uses and actions. And initially you go, well, how can that be possible? And the reason that it's possible is because unlike pharmaceuticals, which are purified down to a single substance, every herb has a phenomenal range of active ingredients within it, a huge range. And there's a whole range of these plant phenolics, these plant phytochemicals, together with different levels of minerals particularly. And so each herb has got a phenomenal range of action. And by combining a number of herbs, you can get multi-systemic effects with, and I tend to use very low doses of the herbs, way lower than is traditional. So I'm kind of sitting them a bit between homeopathy and herbs, really. And in most cases, that's highly effective, unless I've got someone with an acute severe disease, say, well, acute COVID, acute pneumonia, these sorts of things, then I will go high dose and hard with the herbs for a few days before I bring the dose down.
Mindful, of course, the usual disclaimers that we're not offering individual medical advice, blah, 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 blah. But let's imagine the archetypal COVID patient at varying levels of severity. What would be some of your ideas of how you might treat them?
So aside from what you would certainly have, you know, most of them will certainly have heard about, so definitely high-dose vitamin C. And when I say high-dose vitamin C, most people think, well, taking a couple of 500-milligram tablets once or twice a day is high dose. That's not high dose. What I'm talking with vitamin C, if we're serious about using vitamin C to activate the immune system, I'm talking saturation of the white blood cells. So our own body, our white blood cells, our leukocytes concentrate vitamin C, and then they use that vitamin C to produce what's called a peroxide burst. We make our own hydrogen peroxide within our body in our neutrophils, which is pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. So to get enough and an acute illness, the body may use around 20 grams of vitamin C a day. So we compare this to, so humans are one of the few animals we don't make our own vitamin C, whereas most other animals do. So weight size, we're a bit comparable to the usual one we use is a goat, let's say. Mm-hmm. A stressed goat will make 20 gram, 30 gram of vitamin C in a day. On an average unstressed day, it'll still make 5 to 10 grams. It still makes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at that historically, we used to be able to get that in the days when foods were organic and they were picked fresh, and particularly if we happened to be blessed enough to live in an area where there were phenomenal pawpaws, or we had access to rosehip or to pomegranates or Davidson plums, or, you know, various things like this. We used to be able to get fairly good vitamin C levels from the foods around us. But these days, very little. And an orange, we think an orange is wonderful if it'll give us 30 milligrams. Compare 30 milligrams to 5, 10 grams. We're obviously nowhere near the ballpark.
Yes, it's kind of ironic that that in the last, say, 50 years, you know, the vitamin C content of fruits and vegetables might have gone down, and particularly since the indigenous equivalents of wild tomatoes and wild oranges. And yet the tetrahydrocannabinol content of cannabis has gone up.
That's right.
Yeah, so there's more stoners and less nourished stoners. Yeah.
It is funny, isn't it? So back to the vitamin C. Mm-hmm. What I suggest for my patients, if we're serious about doing it, is actually taking around a 3,000 milligram dose hourly until we reach what's called bowel tolerance. Now, a lot of people think that means that you've actually received a toxic dose of vitamin C. Well, no, you haven't. It's just that at that point, the white blood cells are then loaded with vitamin C and the gut says, thank you, that's okay, I don't need to absorb anymore. And so what you then do is you drop down from an hourly dose to a 2-hourly dose, same thing, until you reach your gut tolerance. Then you drop back to a 3-hourly, you drop back to a 4th-hourly, you drop back to 4 times a day and sit on 4 times a day until you're well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So that gut tolerance level varies for individuals. You know, there are some people, particularly they're really sick and really toxic. I've had some patients not reach gut tolerance for even 3 weeks of taking hourly vitamin C every waking hour.
And I imagine that there's evidence behind this, because it's bold for you to mention vitamin C and not vitamin D, because there's this huge amount of evidence out there for vitamin D. But, you know, a lot of medicos might be listening to this, and if they remember their history, they'd say, oh, didn't Linus Pauling fall on the sword of vitamin C? It doesn't work, but you've had experience.
Yeah,
it works.
It's all about. Yeah, the problem that we have is that most of your studies based around vitamin C are using minuscule doses.
Mm-hmm.
Compared, when you actually go back and look into the biochemistry and the comparison to other animal needs, most of our studies think they're wonderful. We're talking around 300 milligram, 500 milligram doses. Now, certainly a 500 milligram dose, it's unlikely to make a statistically significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
I'm strong on vitamin C, as is Ian Brighthope, but I'm particularly strong on it because personally IV vitamin C has saved my life twice, literally. One in ICU where I had an 85% chance of dying, and another time when I was nearly killed in a chemical explosion with chloroform and hydrochloric acid.
Wow.
And after it's quite a crazy story. But my bloods after that were reported. In fact, they reported it and then basically said, well, this can't be right. My potassium was 25 and my anion gap, I forget what my anion gap was now. It was horrendous as well. So basically I'd lysed all my blood cells. So I was seriously sick.
Yes.
So IV vitamin C in both those situations saved my life, and I shouldn't have made it otherwise. It is now being used in some initial clinical trials for sepsis, but again, minuscule doses. I had 30 gram and 60 gram IV doses. The doses that they're playing with in the sepsis trials now are only 3 gram, which is way too low.
So you can set a trial up for failing, but that's made me think of the experiences of many patients that we've heard from personally, and their families from personally, where they've had COVID, they've been in hospital, and the treating teams, they haven't adopted the attitude as, well, we don't believe this nutritional stuff works, but we'll let you have it. They've actually been militantly opposed to these supplements being given to the patients, these family members, what have they got to be afraid of?
That's exactly the point. What have you got to be afraid of? It is ludicrous. I did have one case which we actually took into Supreme Court in a COVID case in hospital. This will ultimately come to further action, so I can't say too much. But the patient was off his own bat, had been taking very, and unbeknownst to me, or I would have shot him sooner, was taking high-dose paracetamol prior to going in hospital. And he was taking 2 grams a day. He was taking 8 tablets. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly now. I have to go back and have a look. But he was right on the edge of toxicity from the paracetamol. Now, the thing about paracetamol is that it requires N-acetylcysteine for the conjugation, for the clearing of the paracetamol. So it depletes the body of N-acetylcysteine. Mm-hmm. N-acetylcysteine we need for the production of the tripeptide glutathione. Mm-hmm. And glutathione is an absolutely key intracellular endogenous antioxidant. It is also a key detoxifier, and it is key for immune system function, for your Th1 immune function. Mm-hmm. So he depleted his system dramatically of N-acetylcysteine and went into hospital. On admission, they didn't take that in the history. They didn't pick that up. Day 1, day 2, they did the usual thing of remdesivir and these other things. In fact, the second he hit hospital, they forcibly sedated him, put him in a coma and intubated him against his will, which is why this is going to be an interesting case.
It will be. But hold that thought. We've got to go to an ad break. This is TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The Supreme Court draft arguing for the reversal of Roe v. Wade, which would overturn federal laws allowing abortion, will be a contentious issue at the midterm elections. Democrats have declared that abortion rights will power their message at elections up and down the country and hope to use this issue to save themselves from an otherwise likely electoral wipeout in November. Opinion polls show that just over half of Americans want the US Supreme Court to uphold Roe v. Wade, but the pro-life side is a significant minority, outnumbering Americans with no strong opinion on the issue. Democrats will have trouble swaying voters just over abortion as the economy continues to disintegrate. And the hypocrisy of Democrats pushing the My Body, My Choice message won't be lost on the millions of Americans forced to take an experimental COVID jab by President Joe Biden's mandate. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
As an organ donor, your story doesn't have to end. The good in you can live on. In fact, you could save up to 8 lives and restore sight and health for many more. Sign up right now online as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You'll be happy you did. And just maybe, someone else will be happy too. Go to organdonor.gov. It saves lives. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
In a March 19 executive order, President Zelensky invoked marital law to ban 11 opposition parties. The outlawed parties consisted of the entire left-wing socialists or anti-NATO parties in Ukraine. Openly fascist and pro-Nazi parties, like the Azov National Corp, were unaffected by the presidential decree. President Zelensky ordered an unprecedented domestic propaganda initiative to nationalize all television news broadcasting and combine all channels into a single 24-hour channel called United News to tell the truth about war. On April 12th, President Zelensky announced the arrest of his main political rival, Viktor Medvedchuk, by the SBU security services.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
This is Robert Brennan with my very special guest, Professor Robin Cosford. And so, yes, you were telling us a disturbing story of a particular treating team in hospital who are opposed to the nutritional treatments that their family and their outside practitioners wanted. That's going to be going to the Supreme Court.
Well, it did go through. So we did get an emergency hearing of Supreme mm-hmm. Court. It did go through the Supreme Court. We were hoping to be able to get nutritional interventions put in. Mm-hmm. They went high with their opposition. It was staggering. I said, that's a separate story, but we were staggered who we ended up against. And basically the judge ended up saying, I can't do anything here. This is outside of my jurisdiction. I can't make the hospital do it. I can't make the hospital let someone else in who can do it. My hands are tied, which was a staggering outcome. But in the meantime, fortunately for this patient, I was hammering this issue of the N-acetylcysteine, because from day two his liver function testing had been deranged. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to really push the point of he's had paracetamol overdose, he needs NAC. He needs NAC on the basis of the paracetamol overdose. If we hadn't have had that, we would have had no in, but we did have that in. Unfortunately, finally, mind you, by the time we got it, we were something like two or might have even been 3 weeks in by this stage. It was a long way in. But nonetheless, we did finally get them to give, and this, bear in mind, he's ventilated. At this stage, by the time we got to the Supreme Court, they expected him to die within 24, 48 hours. He had ventilator lung damage. He was looking really bad. So they were expecting him to die. And, of course, they were resisting absolutely everything, but we managed to get them to concede N-acetylcysteine on the paracetamol overdose protocol, which is much less than I would have wanted. But nonetheless, we got that in. And on the back of that, he turned and did make it off the ventilator and did get discharged from hospital. He is alive to tell the tale himself.
But the danger is that when you have treating teams that don't collaborate with families and don't act according to their values and wishes, incorporate that into the holistic treatment plan, is you end up with a culture of where patients will be reluctant to go to hospital in the first place, and if they need to. And so, you know, you've got to look at the big picture.
Absolutely.
And you're talking
and
about...
What was it? Was that their response in the Supreme Court hearing was, we are not going to do anything outside of protocol, because mm-hmm. even though at this stage the patient, actually we were a fair way in because he was already post-COVID, so he was past day 28. They said, we're not going to do anything that is against our protocols, because we can't let anyone else see it. We can't have it be seen that we are doing anything outside the allowed protocols.
Uh-huh. And we could talk for hours, and probably we'll get you back for parts two or three or four or N. But, you know, I'm always one to say that all viruses are different and all vaccines are different. They have to be evaluated according to their own properties and merits and that. But, you know, here's a story about smallpox. You know, there was Edward Jenner and his observations of the milkmaids. And... you know, what he found was an in principle case that was before him of they were exposed to cowpox. It gave them cross immunity to smallpox. So we've known for since what, 1798 or thereabouts, about the principles of cross immunity that we can apply potentially to various coronaviruses. That he also discovered persisting immunity. Something which is once again, it's known for a couple of hundred years. And so when you think back at that and think of now the concept of natural immunity re SARS-CoV-2, what's your thoughts?
Well, this is what I find staggering about the whole of what is being promulgated now, and that is that, as you correctly say, like centuries of immunology learning. Centuries of observing what happens in infection and with natural immunity post-infection has been thrown out the window. And we are being told that the only way you can have any protection against this virus is to be injected with a particular injection. And yet the problem is that there are several things here. This injection, by all accounts and admitted even within the system, is what we would call an incomplete vaccine, in the sense that it does not stop transmission. So if we're not stopping transmission and we are vaccinating in the face of active transmission, then that obviously is putting evolutionary pressure on that organism, if indeed we're talking, whatever it is we're talking here, it puts evolutionary pressure on it to evade what it is we are injecting.
Yes.
And this is exactly what's happening. You know, that the spike protein is mutating, and it's mutating, some researchers say it's mutating back to its original form before we manipulated it. That's another story. Mm-hmm. But it is mutating. And because these injections and certainly the mRNA that we have here in Australia are working by getting our own system to manufacture in an ongoing way the spike protein according to the injection, because that's modified again. The spike protein in the injection is not the same as the spike protein in the wild virus. So it's altered. So we can only make antibodies to match the unless we were lucky enough to have COVID beforehand, we can only make antibodies to match the spike protein in the injection, which we are then manufacturing in an ongoing way because that's the way the mRNA works. And we still don't know how long that effect is going to go on for, but quite some time. And so we are unable to manufacture broad-based antibodies. We can only make this one very specific antibody, which we are making in an ongoing way. And the evidence is very clear that this one specific antibody, from the patterns we are seeing with the correlation between the rollout of increasing vaccination and the increasing level of COVID, that these injections, these vaccines are not producing neutralizing antibodies. They're no longer neutralizing because the spike protein has altered because of the evolutionary pressures that we're putting on it, because we're vaccinating in the face of an active epidemic, an active infection wave. It's just we've thrown out every bit of known immunology and known everything in this current process. We've totally thrown out the idea of herd immunity, you know, what natural immunity used to mean. Natural immunity was well recognized and used to mean that we knew that once someone had had an infection with a particular type of virus, that they had antibodies which would be there produced at the time of the virus. Then they would, as it were, the body would kind of go to sleep and say, okay, I've remembered how to do that. I'll switch that on again later if I need to. And then when the body is re-exposed to something either the same or similar enough, it says, yes, I remember how to do that. Switches those antibodies back on and you're fine. Whereas because these people are stuck in a situation where they are perpetually making these antibodies, the body never gets the downtime. So we are now moving into situations where we see on the papers coming out now and on the studies where we are actually getting immune exhaustion, we're getting T cell exhaustion, which is creating a whole other set of immune disorders and immune diseases. So it's just a deeply, deeply concerning situation.
Yes, but yet, as you say, it's something that we might have predicted from basic immunology, and the likes of, you know, Gert van den Bosch and Robert Malone have been telling us, and they've been vindicated.
Yeah, they have been absolutely vindicated. Everything they warned us about has been proven. It's happening. Sadly, tragically, very concerningly.
Which isn't to imply that there's not a place for any vaccines at all, but it's preferable if it's something that's a live attenuated virus. It's a representation of the bug as a whole that the body sees as something which it can, in being exposed to multiple antigens, it induces multiple antibody responses, and it's something that's more attuned to the natural exposure to the virus, but without the sting. Without the sting, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that it's something that comes in and then goes again. It's not there perpetually, creating an ongoing inflammatory response and an ongoing need for the body to try to make antibodies to deal with it, because it is still there. There's no, infections don't work like that. They're there. The body gets an immune response. We clear it unless it gets reactivated. But yes, that's the problem, that the mechanism of what we've done here is simply not in line with how the immune system functions, and so we're triggering the abnormal reactions and responses, the like of which has never, we've never done this before, the like of which has never been seen before. We've got no disease comparisons. You know, we've got nothing to hang our hat on, because there isn't any disease that behaves like this.
And some have remarked, though, that Omicron is that live attenuated virus in the sense that it has lower virility than the Delta or the original Wuhan strain. And so, you know, why not let it rip and let everybody get Omicron, although it's a bit taboo to use that term, let it rip, as if, no, we can't do that. Now, it perhaps speaks of an attitude in medical culture, because, you know, it's the idea of the razor surgical specific thing that is delivery of the spike protein, because it's the same sort of argument that's used against herbal medicine. They say, well, it's not a specific single molecular unit, it's a specific dose. So yes, it's the unknown, it's a hodgepodge,
Well, exactly. But if we're going to take that argument, why are we eating food? If we're going to take that argument, then we need to do, as I think Bill Gates would like us to do, but we need to shift across to totally synthetic monomolecular substances for our foods.
Yes.
Because when you look at vegetables, really a herb is a concentrated vegetable, for want of a better analogy. As in, it has a much more concentrated and intense range of phytonutrients. But your superfoods have got this as well. You know, we look across the berries, we look into kale, we look into these sorts of foods, and you find that they have a massive array of plant chemicals and different levels of vitamins and minerals and things in them. So they are not pure in that sense. So our bodies are well used, and in fact they're designed to take this multiplicity of plant chemicals and then send them around the place. So the difference with your plant chemicals, your phytonutrients, as compared to just the molecular structures of, say, carbohydrate, protein, vitamin, mineral, is that all your plant chemicals, so the flavonoids, you know, your bioflavonoids and so on, are actually messengers. They're actually messaging to cell receptors and things like that. They're messenger systems. They're not structural, and they're not actually nutritional. Your vitamins and your minerals work as cofactors in your biochemical pathways. Your proteins and your carbohydrates are your structural things, particularly your proteins and your fats. They're kind of your structural things. Carbs, of course, will break down and come into the what we call the TCA cycle.
Ah, yes, I memorized that, and then I forgot about it the day after the exam.
That's
what we did.
That's where my brain was a bit crazy when I went through. I loved the biochem. I got an HD in biochem on the way through, and what I did was I wrote out all my own biochemical pathways. And wrote down all these cofactors for all these things. And that actually was what got me into nutrition, because it was the looking at these pathways and going, hey, oh, look, magnesium and B6 work together there to make that pathway work. And if that pathway works, then that converts to that. And, oh, look, that's the neurotransmitters. And so, you know, I actually got to see how food and nutrition literally works down on the biochemical level. But your plants are different. The phytonutrients don't work like that.
Ah, now we're gonna have to have dear listeners, Professor Robin Cosford on back on TNT Radio. By the way, Robin, do you have a website or something that we can reach you?
Yes, I'll tell you it. It is still in the processes of getting together, because I'm new to this realm.
Well, then we'll plug it in future sessions.
Because I've been running a low profile before now, but now it's like, no, but now I'm out there now.
We're out there, out and proud. Okay, so this is TNT Radio. Professor Robin Cosford has been my guest. Good evening.